You're listening to the Racking Focus Podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Racking Focus Podcast. I'm Josiah Blizzard.
And I'm John Doyle. And it may have been a long time between podcasts for you, and it's been a long time between podcasts for us. And as movie theaters are starting to open, we thought we would get ourselves back in gear by watching something in my house.
Well, you know, we were going to go to the theater I was thinking of doing a double feature today in theaters and watching Russell Crowe get unhinged and some zombies attack.
Right.
The Peninsula. But both of our wives said no.
You can't go yet. Emphatically said no.
So we ended up with First Cow on the couch.
Which had been something we'd talked about seeing back before the COVID.
It's been on our list, right?
Right. But
where can they watch First Cow before we get into this?
So it's available on iTunes Movies. You can buy it there. It's only about $15 to purchase, $4.95, I guess, to rent. But you can also get it on Amazon has it for available for streaming as well, but in both cases you have to pay a rental fee.
Cool. Well, I will say that this movie's not for everybody. So
right,
if you don't like slow-paced, I don't know, man, like it's a slow film, and that's not a bad thing, but I know that there's a lot of my friends who would say, I hated that movie. Why did you make me watch this once it ends? My wife being one of those people.
It is methodical and, paced in a way that gives us tons of opportunity to examine the frame.
Yeah.
Which can be for some people something that isn't actually interesting.
Yeah, right. And hey, real quick, there are spoilers coming.
Oh, that's right.
Didn't warn you of that, but there are spoilers. Although there's really not much to spoil, because the biggest spoiler of the entire thing is given to us at the very beginning of the movie. And that is that this woman with dog finds two skeletons laying in the dirt, who we will assume are our two main characters. Your cat's going nuts next to me right now.
Absolutely.
Who we assume are the two main characters, and in fact they are the two main characters as far as we know at the end of the film. I mean, it just kind of cuts to black with them laying in the same formation that their skeletons were found in, but I was waiting for them to switch and do kind of like a bait and switch with us, and it being two other random people, and our main characters end up getting to California or something like that and running off, and it's two other bodies that are laying there. Did you think about that at any point?
So there was a moment when I thought we were going to have one of the two would be different.
Yeah.
But as the movie progressed, it just felt like this was not a movie that was about surprises.
Yeah.
It was a movie about experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, the opening sequence is really fascinating. There's that extraordinarily long boat that moves down or up river.
Up river, down river, I don't know.
And it just took quite a while to move through the scene, and it was contemporary. And I'm immediately like, where are we? And
well, I was so thrown off by the 4:3 aspect ratio.
Right.
And I really thought that they were gonna play with that 4:3 aspect ratio based on the time period, because we started contemporary. And I thought, okay, 4:3, maybe they're going to do like this flashback thing back and forth for some reason. And they just didn't.
Nope,
so,
stayed right in 4:3.
Yeah.
We see this opening sequence, which takes quite a while, right? In terms of something like a cold open, in that sort of pre-real story concept, it was a full scene unto itself. If you struggle with that, you're going
to
struggle.
You'll know in the first 5 minutes whether or not you're going to be able to make it through this movie. The opening sequence is a short film.
Right.
Like by itself, they could have cut after she found the skeletons.
And it would be a short film.
And it would have been a short film. Absolutely. That would have been it. And it would have been a better short film from any of film school that I, like any of the short films that came out of college.
The other thing that the opening does is it sets us in nature. And it sets us in nature today, and it's so I mean, it's clearly not built up.
Yeah.
You know, this, it still feels like wilderness.
Well, that barge that came in the opening shot felt so out of place.
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, strangely enough, as we enter the movie and we get into the history and we go back to the past, the wilderness is truly a wilderness. And where she was where, you know, in the beginning was quite a comfortable place. But right in the beginning, you're established that this incredible vibrancy of color and this color palette that exists through the whole film.
Yeah.
And this extraordinary engagement with detail and with animal life or natural life, maybe. And those, it's just imprinted on you right from the start.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is very organic feeling from, I mean, even the aspect ratio they use feels organic in the sense of like 4x3 is what it was for so long.
Right.
And that to me feels just old, and it just felt natural. Like I think 16x9 would have felt a little weird, actually, thinking about the film being shot in that way. And if you watch we just watched the iTunes extras, and that gave a lot of insight to why they chose that. But everything they're using from, I mean, they said they used the bark from the trees in that area to build parts of the sets. They didn't just ship in some random wood from somewhere. Everything feels really, really cohesive. And the color palette, like you mentioned, is really beautiful. Lots of yellows, lots of beiges, tans.
Yeah, there's
like, it's, there, yeah, there's the color palette's organic in the sense too. I mean, obviously it would be, it's taking place in the woods, but even the lighting felt completely natural. I mean, there's times where I'm like, I don't think they're using any artificial lighting at all.
We heard in the little post-doc that we watched that, you know, they did everything in camera.
Yeah.
And it definitely shows. I mean, it shows that we're talking about, this is definitely shooting at night. And that's another thing for those of you who are considering watching the film. If you do not like obscured views where you need to really pay attention to watch the action, it's another one of those things that could be challenging to a viewer.
I mean, we had a major glare here. Well, so I would say watch this at night if you're
For sure.
If you're gonna watch this at night, and make sure it's in a dark room. I mean, I had to get up at one point to see the TV fully. I mean, we wondered that whole time, like, if this, I mean,
well, we knew it wasn't day for night.
We knew it wasn't day for night, but
how little light they were using.
I mean, I'm convinced they used moonlight for parts of this. I don't know. There was not much light at all. But I will say that the film overall is very precise in what it shows you, I think. Yeah. Like, each shot is so thought out. It's not like they just decided to throw shots into the film, into the cut. Like, everything feels very, very planned out, you know?
Well, there is no use of, I mean, the cutaway is not to solve a problem in the movement of image or in the editing.
Yeah.
Cutaways are all completely deliberate. They're not that sort of functional cutaway you might see where we're trying to redirect, because we sit in shots for a long time.
Yeah, it never felt like they were shooting for coverage.
Right.
You know, it felt like they were shooting because this is the shot they want from this point to this point.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that they knew the edit up front before they even started to shoot. That's how it felt to me anyway.
Well, yeah, I think, and whether that's done at a storyboard level or it's done in a rehearsal level or whatever, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of extraneous activity.
Yeah.
Or, you know, when they're sitting in the editing bay, they're looking at 15 different angles. I think they may be looking at 15 different takes, but not 15 different angles.
Yeah.
And that was pretty interesting.
Well, and there's shots in the film that I feel like wouldn't necessarily make the cut of another film. This is super indie, right? Like, this is probably the most indie that A24 gets with their distribution, like with the movies that they're producing. Like, this made, I think, in their box office, I saw it made $101,000 or something. Like, that's their box office success. And granted, that's with COVID numbers, because this was supposed to come out in theaters earlier this year.
Right.
But, you know, there's this shot, I think, of, and it feels almost pointless other than telling us that the chief factor's asleep, and it's this slider shot that goes from his head to his feet and then back up to his head. Like, it would have been easy enough for them to just show the guy, the Native American guy, putting out the candles and then getting into bed, and that would have been so much faster, so much quicker. But I mean, they chose to go this other route just for the pacing and like the way they want you to feel. And I don't even know what they wanted me to feel, but I don't know. I don't know. Like, it's just every decision was thought out on the filmmaker's part.
And there is this, I mean, I think when you talk about slow, we need to just say that there's a deliberative pace to the movie.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the world that we're seeing. So
that's true too.
It's a world where there is only time. Yeah. You know, no one's in a rush.
Yeah.
And because there isn't any reason to rush.
There's nothing to do.
There's nothing to do.
Yeah.
You're living, and so the pace is really legitimate, but that also means that when you're doing that with all of the tools you have, those shots need to take their time, and you don't want them to be static, right? Because this world isn't static.
Yeah.
And so the slider, or all of the work that's done with cameras that are flying in some way, all of that is part of keeping the piece moving, even though that movement is methodical and slow.
It's not like I think when we were listening to the behind the scenes, they mentioned, I thought I heard them mention Ozu.
They mentioned,
and he, I mean, slow paced filmmaker, right? And he's the opposite of movement. He's slow, and he'll put a low angle on the floor of the of your Japanese house, and you'll be stuck watching people walk through the house for 15 minutes, and it's slow, and boy, I have a hard time.
See, I like that.
No, I had a hard time. I could not. I don't think I made it through Tokyo Story.
Yeah.
But this is it's similar to his style of filmmaking, but it's, you have movement in those frames and in those shots.
Well, and you also have all of this obscured vision. So I mean, there are plenty of shots where we see someone's, I mean, if there's a close up of face or whatever, like a clear, clean shot.
Yeah.
But most of the framing is obscured by whether it's objects in the foreground, or it's environment in the foreground and background, or it's the buildings, or we continually are seeing things through.
Yeah.
As opposed to
with
a clear field of view.
My favorite shot in the whole thing may be him splitting the wood through the window, and Cookie going in and out of the doorway. And
they're crossing paths, right? And they're in proximity,
and the focus feels really deep. Like, it feels like they've stopped all the way down there in their aperture. And it reminded me of Citizen Kane.
Okay.
With the deep window.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the mirror, but I've seen enough clips from Cinefix's YouTube channel from the mirror that it reminded me of the woman standing in the doorway, I think, watching the barn burn down, or whatever building burn down. Those are the two images.
And I have seen that film, and that's a great call out, right?
Okay.
Even though the vibe of that work is different.
Yeah.
The way that the length and the focus of takes, the difference here is so much of what we see, there is this actor, the actor is surrounded as opposed to we're seeing the actor in a place. It's this actor surrounded. I wanted to say how much the environment is just a completely present participant.
Yeah.
I don't want to say a character, because I think that cheapens sort of what's going on. They are actively engaged in their relationship with nature from the beginning of the film, when we're digging up.
Right.
And we don't just, we don't dig up those corpses or those skeletons in a second.
It takes time.
And it's because of all that encounter with the brown, rotted peat that's in the ground, and the same thing we find over and over again, moving through trees, moving through water, whatever it is, there is this constant encounter with nature that we see clearly, even though it's full of obstructions.
I mean, the fact that they built all of these locations, to immerse your actors in the sets, and I mean, they were saying this behind the scenes, like, I mean, even the wardrobe, you know, you walk into the costume designer's room and you leave, it's like you went through a time machine, and all of a sudden you're in these outfits. That the outfits looked amazing, by the way. Like every outfit in this piece looked so authentic, and I can't speak on what they actually wore back then. I don't even know what year this takes place in.
But
I'm assuming sometime in the 1800s, obviously, but everything just looked so authentic and you have a whole variety of different wardrobe because of how many different types of people are in this area. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the type of people that Cookie portrays, who is like just the random guy who's out on the West Coast, part of a trapping team, or maybe they're looking for gold or whatever it is too. Like, you have those types of people. You have, King, what's his name? King, our Chinese character, King Liu.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his outfit's completely different, and it definitely has a more, Chinese feel. But then you have the Native Americans and the Frenchmen and the Englishmen, and you have like all these people, and each outfit completely represents that character's heritage in some way. We had a Hawaiian, apparently, which I didn't know until the credits rolled, that there was a Hawaiian woman. Didn't know she was Hawaiian when she was doing her movement through the window. I thought she was another Native American, and that's on me. I don't know. Like, I wasn't aware, but I loved how much diversity was represented in the film and in the wardrobe and costume design, even. So,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it's full of specificity of place,
yeah,
costume, production design, that we joked about the whisk being something that my daughter and your wife, but now speaking of two separate people, actually,
both
my daughters,
and one of them
is your wife, would never have accepted that whisk. In the same way that the pot, the way the the baking was being done, was all so true to the period and so specific and so cleanly done. But the costumes were incredible. I do have to ask, and if anyone wants to answer this question, I need to know why people in this environment were all wearing fringe. There has to be a reason, because it seems to me it is both a pain in the neck to make.
Yeah.
And we'll get caught on everything. I don't know. Someone out there who has, history experience, if you want to write something about why everyone's wearing fringe, or not everyone, but the trapper folks wearing fringe. I mean, I think the details of the trap set for the squirrels was incredible. I mean, and the time the camera took, the lingering on the shot of those being reset up more than once, gives us an understanding of where these people are and who they are and how they're living.
Yeah. Did they ever tell us why King Liu came across to America? Because there's two shots. And the only reason I asked this is we get two shots of him swimming away from his problems. And I don't know if that has anything to do with his history. I don't know if I missed it. I don't know if he ran away from his or crossed the sea to get away from his problems in China. Or what, but he's the only character we see swim in this movie twice,
mm-hmm.
and he's running away from two things both those times.
Yeah, I think that, I don't think we learn that.
Yeah.
Because we actually don't learn a great deal of detail about, except for Cookie. We do get some pretty specific information about Cookie.
Yeah.
We do know that his experience, he's from North China, right?
Oh, that's right.
He's the disrespected northerner.
Right.
But I think that that's a perfectly good look at what he's doing, because he is running away through the whole film.
Yeah.
When we first meet him, he's both naked and running away.
Right.
And I think we see, that nakedness and the clothing of him that Cookie does is metaphorically guiding us through the whole process as to what this story is about.
I mean, yeah.
Often, when we see a line of poetry at the beginning of a film, it is not obvious necessarily what that means to the story.
This was as blatant and in your face as it could possibly be. And it's fine. It didn't feel like I knew what it was going to be.
Right.
The second I saw that, the second that that quote came up, and then it was paired with the two skeletons next to each other. I knew 100% where this movie was going. And the predictability is not bad.
No.
Like, I was fine with the predictability there.
I mean, it certainly nails it, right? Like, yeah. It tells the story of how a relationship blossoms and grows and how meaningful it can be.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say, too, is, and you said something at the end about the pacing that I want to say something about it at the beginning and you can talk about it, is that this is a world of threat.
Yeah.
For all of the nature, I felt like at least our main characters, if not all of the characters, were under threat, were in danger from beginning to end. And there's that line, you know, if it's not worth doing if it's not a little dangerous, or that phrase plays out. This is a place, I mean, I felt like Cookie was at risk.
Well, there's two danger lines that were said. I don't remember what the second one was, but that first one, I mean, there's no rules out here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could just kill a man in the street, and unless the chief does something, then I mean the chief said, I'm gonna kill the guy for milking my cow.
Right.
Like, here, if I went to Norview Farmed and milked their cow while they were sleeping, the most I'll get is probably a fine of some sort for trespassing, probably not even for milking their cow. So like the stakes are high for any little thing you do out in Oregon, apparently. But yeah, it is a world full of danger, and there were two danger lines. I don't remember what the second one was, but it was constantly stressed. And for as much of a, I'm going to say that King Lou is a little bit of a coward in a way. We talk about him running away, but this is a moment after he's clothed, he starts to, he bucks up a little bit, right? Like he's actually spouts out a lot of wisdom. There's like four or five cuts where it just starts with like a wisdomous line of some sort. As if he's a fortune cookie, which is really, really bad since he's a Chinese man.
Right.
That it's just the Chinese guy is given all the wisdom. But it was all good. It was all good stuff. But I'm like, is he actually following any of this stuff in his actual life, or is he only doing this because Cookie's around? And it felt a little bit like he's taking advantage of Cookie at the beginning. And then they're truly friends. So I'm fine with everything that happened, but I was worried that he was taking advantage of Cookie and greed. I mean, greed plays into this whole thing, right?
Right. And need, right? The both ends of that, it's interesting because, you know, these two guys, they have a plan. They have a plot that they're pulling off. Right. And there's a little bit of illegality in it. And there certainly is risk and whatever, but that plot that they're working on together, the together is the part of the story that matters. But we naturally believe, as we flow through film and our experience today and whatever sort of understandings we have about narrative and plot structure, is that there is going to be a betrayal.
Yeah.
That the money in the tree is going to become a plot point between them.
Right.
Or, you know,
A movie like this, we can expect, even if we're not expecting it subconsciously, we can expect for those two people, the two friends in a buddy movie, to come apart. Happens in almost every buddy film ever, Dumb and Dumber included. It happens where two main characters split in just before the third act, and then they come back together at the climax to support each other and solve whatever major issue they're going to overcome together. And we don't get that in this, because there was the splitting up didn't occur because they were betraying each other, but it occurred out of necessity for survival.
Right.
And it was completely accidental, right? Like, for all we know, Cookie can't swim. And
right. Cause he makes the choice not to do that leap into the water.
He decides not to run away, but instead hide. And King Lou decides to run away and or swim away, and they're split at that point. That's their split. Mm-hmm. But there's actually never any overcoming their problem, right, or solution. They just kind of, they just die together, mm-hmm, right? So it's almost as if this ends before the climax where the solution right, happens. But that's how life is. Like, mm-hmm, and back then life is so unpredictable. I'm assuming that, and this is where we can get to that danger talk. I'm assuming that the guy caught up with them and shot them both while they were sleeping.
That certainly felt like what happened,
or,
right?
Or I was almost expecting him to just shoot King Lou and for him to just die there and for Cookie to have already been dead from his head wound.
Right.
I mean, it's a tragic ending in any way, but it's such a dangerous era that you died when you're 40 years old or 50 years old back then. Like, that's it. Like,
right,
that's your life expectancy. So to get on with what you were saying about the pacing and the danger, mm-hmm, I can't tell you how there was some tension at the end there after they cut to the guy watching Cookie with the gun, right?
Right.
And this, right, is the guy, yeah, who's been pushed around the whole movie.
Yeah, he's didn't take it well, right? Like, so yeah, the actor's doing really nice work.
Yeah. And, you know, they cut to him a few times with the gun kind of hunting these two. And it's just shot after shot of Cookie and King Lou walking through the woods. I'm just waiting for that moment where you hear the gun sound ring out and you're
right,
into the chest.
Right, in those last
and the freeze
moments.
Yes, mm-hmm. I was waiting for it. And because it's the wilderness, I don't know where they were, where their bodies were in the beginning of the film. I don't remember what this scenery looked like. They could have been anywhere
well,
that
needed
they were.
To change, right? Like, right, it's year. It's
right. It's 100 years, 150 right, years, right? Like, it could have changed easily. So it literally could have been shot at any moment. I was just waiting for that sound. And that's where I think the slow paced filmmaking really kind of shines in that aspect, because it makes you have to wait,
mm-hmm,
and you don't know when it's going to happen. And because everything's been going so slow for the entire film, it could be four shots from now before they get shot, or it could be one
long shot.
Right. You have no, and you, yeah, don't know when it's going to be. So, there's a lot of tension there for me. A lot of tension.
Yeah. I love the music. I thought it, uh-huh, was, yeah, cleverly done. It makes its appearance primarily when, you know, Cookie's present and Cookie's in,
right,
like this sort of theme of the piece.
Right. It was, it
he's
felt like the
nature,
same kind of riff, right? The same kind, yep, of notes. Yeah.
I love that there are animals all over the place. I have to say in the doc, they talked a little bit about the quote unquote casting of the cow.
Yeah.
What, as that cow in the barge is moving upriver, I guess. I
don't know. I don't know my rivers.
I don't know what river. What it has to be upriver, I guess, if it's traveling that direction. Anyway,
is upriver north and downriver south, or is it based on current flow?
Look, I'm not Mark Twain. I don't have any concept of any of that. Show my city nature. But I will say this: that my first thought was like, that's a perfectly cast cow. Like, that is the image,
yeah, oh, yeah,
of cow.
Yeah.
And I was like, how many cows must they have gone through? And it seems like they made some serious choices, yeah, about choosing that particular cow.
Yeah.
The relationship between Cookie and the cow is adorable, uh-huh, and really well done. And part of what I want to say about music, sound, etc., is nobody's yelling in this film.
Mm, mm-mm. Mm-mm.
The most threatening lines are delivered at a speech, the normal tone of speech.
Well, and the most hostile really anybody gets is over some fried cake, like when they're fighting for the cake a little bit. Oh, I guess they did whatever the guy in the bar,
the guy in the bar thing,
they were pretty mean to that guy.
Yeah, and he was, but it was all just talking, right?
Yeah,
it
was just,
no, they weren't yelling, they weren't, and yeah, the guy says, here, watch my kid while I'll be back, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the same thing when the first trapper threatens Cookie,
right,
and says, you know, I'm going to meet you and I'm going to get your bag of gold. He doesn't scream it. It's just clear.
Yeah.
It's, everything's about this sort of interpersonal intensity.
Yeah.
And it was valuable in the fact that it keeps us in the same tone that the rest of the film is in.
Yeah, agreed. Let's see, what else do we want to talk about?
We haven't talked about directing and acting in any significant way. You want to?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know I don't know how to really talk about the acting all that much in this film, because it felt very, like you said, there wasn't really any change in the dynamic of emotion.
Right.
You know, and that's just how the film was written. So, I mean, I think the acting for everybody was great. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was good. It wasn't anything that like really blew me away or shocked me, anything like that.
I felt like it was a very naturalistic kind of acting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And as a result, there's integrity to their emotion and their relationships, but no one's out there chewing up scenery.
Right.
You know, they're doing the work of beings in this space. I mean, I thought that I taste a little bit of England, Chief Factor, right?
Yeah.
Shares with us. And that is, was acted beautifully, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like that was a really gorgeous moment. But it's certainly not, you know, big, broad acting, and it's not some internal kind of emotional exploration. It's being as the person in the world, and that naturalism is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And fit with the rest of the story.
It felt very true to life. I mean, people go through their entire day, or sometimes weeks, without yelling or raising their voice and just being this calm person. So,
And that's Toby Jones, and he can go the distance.
Right.
So, you know, as an actor, he can be big and broad and stylized, and he's not. And that was pretty.
I thought the acting was good. Direction, I mean, it sounded like Kelly. What was her name? Reichard. It was thought out. The film was very well planned, very well thought out, very well paced, very like all of the things that the director has to take care of. The tonality of the entire film was consistent from beginning to end. I've never heard of her before. I've never heard of this director.
I think she has one other film on IMDb. I think there's one other.
Okay. I'll have to click on her page here in a second. But, I thought she did a great job. So she has known for Wendy and Lucy, which was in 2008, Certain Women in 2016, and Old Joy in 2006. And then Night Moves in 2013. That one stars Jesse Eisenberg and Dakota Fanning and Peter Sarsgaard. And Girl with Dog.
Yeah, Girl with Dog. Girl with Dog is one of the two leads, right?
Yeah.
For the purposes.
Well, it's funny, on IMDb, Girl with Dog is a top billed cast.
Right. That's really
next to Cookie. Yeah, that's interesting, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think she did. I think Kelly Reichardt did a great job with the direction. I mean, it's the direction was. I feel like it was less of giving your actors specific notes and more of the entire vibe of like everything. Like this is such an indie film that the director is really running so much of. I would assume the production, obviously you have producers and cinematographers and production designers all giving their input, but when it comes down to the story and like you don't have a studio behind you that is gonna make you do things,
right.
And so for a movie like this to get made, it's really the director's vision that has to be so strong and so focused and so precise that's the only way the movie's gonna be successful and get made.
I think this is definite, and we can say, you know, I want to put this in contrast to Ari Aster, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing is true of Aster.
Yeah.
Except because of the energy and the genre of those films, sometimes it feels like there are touchstones to other, a less intimate vision.
Yeah.
But Aster's vision is completely Astor's vision.
You know? For sure. Well, that's what A24 does best is they bring these filmmakers out that and they have. I don't know how A24 does their selection process or like how they work 100%, but I don't know if they're funding. I just know that A24 is at least distribution. But you have all these filmmakers who have these visions, and that's partially why I love the A24 films so much, is because I know that when I watch any film from A24, it's the director's vision that has been brought to the screen that hasn't been, or has been maybe at minorly influenced by a studio or somebody that is like an executive or something.
Right. So there's
else, right.
Like, no matter what, there's money around these pictures,
sure.
But these are definitely the individual vision. And, you know, we're looking right now, you and I have been talking a lot about the DC universe and the influence that the studio has over that. And here they are hiring directors who have specific visions, and that the movies don't look like that.
Right.
Because they aren't really given their vision, right? They're given a look that directors allowed to have a look maybe, but the dollar and the audience becomes primary.
Yeah.
Here for A24, it is always about that director's vision.
Yeah.
And there's something about, you know, we see references to great and classic cinema in this movie's vibe, its feel.
Yeah.
And that's what's being accessed by the director.
Right.
So if the director's not doing their own eye, they're channeling great directors or great imagery they've experienced as a filmmaker.
Right.
Instead of imagery that they know has been successful with audiences.
Yeah.
Which is why this can be a challenging film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The direction was great. I enjoyed the direction. But other than that, I don't know where else to go. Do you have anywhere else to go?
No, I think we've done the job we need to do talking about this movie.
Yeah.
So why don't we rate and wrap, and then we'll, you know, get ready to do more again.
Well, since I didn't have the chance to see this in the theater, I'm going to say like this is a good at-home movie. I think in the theater it would be kind of weird in 4x3, maybe.
I remember seeing The Lighthouse, right? And
that was in 4x3, wasn't it?
That was in 4x3.
Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that.
It was even tighter. No, it was even tighter than that. Like that was at.
Was it in like 1x1?
I don't remember. I'm gonna look it up.
I don't know. But you know, yeah, maybe I forgot The Lighthouse was in that aspect ratio.
Yeah.
But I mean, I would say like, yeah, this would be good in theaters, but it's equally as good at home. I feel like there's not anything that is, I mean, the sound design was wonderful in the film. We didn't talk about that, but like the sound design was great. Like nothing really to pick up on there, but, I mean, sure. Everything sounds better in the theater. Everything looks better in the theater on a nice projector. So I would say like, you're not going to actually miss much though. If you saw this at home, just make sure that you don't have a giant glare on your TV screen. That way you can see the very dark shots in, like, they are dark. So
very, very,
very
dark.
Watch this in your basement. So I'm going to say, I mean, watch it at home, but if you have the money and you can find it in a theater, then go for it.
I think this would have been cool to see on a big screen where some things that were more difficult in our space to see, like the grain, and that sense of height that the director talked about that I think is really legitimate in the 4x3.
Yeah, sure.
I think those things, sitting in a theater, looking up at an up angle on a screen, might have been powerful, but I don't think this movie suffers greatly from home viewing.
Yeah.
I think that if you have a decent sound and a decent television, you're going to be fine watching it. And because of the challenge of it as a film, for a popular audience, it is great to say watch it on video.
Yeah.
Because the risk of going to the theater for someone is higher,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And so if you're at home and you need to take the break because you are having difficulty with the pacing, you can do that here, where if you walk out of the theater when it's running straight through in a stream, you're just going to break the whole experience.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
I think it's worth seeing. I think it's worth seeing with the caveat you need to know that you're watching a film that is beautiful and charming and heartfelt and meaningful,
yeah,
and methodical and
for sure
slow paced.
Yeah.
The first review, when I, you know, when I went to IMDb just to make sure I had names correct, the first review I see is, "Don't watch this if you are easily bored." That's the first review. That's on a review that's like a 7 review. Yeah. Like, it's not a bad review, but the review is honest. And I think that that's something that's true. And I've been spending my summer, you know, on Criterion. That could well be a bird that ran into our window behind me, which happens a lot in my neighborhood. Well, I've been watching all of these classic films. I've been spending a tremendous amount of time on the Criterion Channel.
Yeah.
And this movie felt as methodically and slowly paced as anything I have watched.
Right.
And I have watched some films with long, long takes. And this really felt like that was the, what we were doing. And I enjoyed it. I'm just making clear that it is a style that you need
for
to prepare
sure. Like
for.
This, I mean, this feels like cinema, right? Like this
right.
is, this is something that, that would fit nicely in that Criterion collection, I'm sure, right? Like
absolutely.
This would just fit in there. It's also a film that, that makes me encouraged. It makes me feel like I could make a movie, you know,
yeah.
with how simplistically, obviously it's not simplistic in any way in the,
right.
in the production design, but it makes me feel like I could get 2 period piece costumes and go out into the woods and just start shooting something and do it in a way that, like, let's not worry about the gear that we have. Let's not worry about the light we have. Let's just make something. And that's how this movie made me feel in the middle of watching it. Like,
well, when you do a film that's all done in camera, you are saying that all of the crazy technology we live with today to do things like color grading and everything,
yeah.
is ultimately second to a masterful director with a solid acting team and an extraordinary crew, right?
So, yeah.
From production design, the costume design, to camera person, the cinematographer,
right.
All of those people are working at their A game as filmmakers.
Yeah.
And together they put together really rock solid work.
Yeah.
Where we often end up today seeing somebody's mistake being corrected and by digital
right.
magicianship. And that means no longer is it in the hands.
Yeah.
of the artists who were building it. Not yeah. to say that those people aren't artists, but it is a different level of artist. And I think that this film, that's really present in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well,
right.
glad we finally watched it.
I'm glad we finally did yeah. a podcast after...
Oh, it's been months.
Months.
It's been, it was, I think the last film we reviewed was Onward back in March, I think.
Yeah, I did something in between. I did Uptown Saturday Night, I think.
Yeah.
I think I did
you
2 films
make,
in
you
the
did
interim.
Mini episode, right?
Just so that we weren't completely vacant.
Yeah.
But we're back now, and I think after we've been able to review how movie theaters are surviving.
Yeah.
Because the RZA has a movie out too. There's a lot of good stuff this first opening weekend. It's frustrating.
That
we have to be conscious about how much integrity the theaters are going to have. So, all right.
Cool. It's been so long. I'm going to see if I can remember all of our social channels.
Oh, they're going to fail at that.
You can find us on Instagram at Racking Focus Podcast. And you can get us on Twitter at Pod Focus. I think that's correct.
That is correct.
Whoa, we have not done this in a long time.
It is Pod Focus.
Yes. And please, if you would be so kind, review us on iTunes, on Apple, or wherever the heck you listen to this podcast, Spotify, where else they have podcasts? Everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah, Podbean. I mean, we can name many different podcasting things.
Yeah, Anchor FM.
Right, Anchor FM, which actually is becoming more and more popular as a platform. So I feel like we've made a good
choice.
And
if you go to anchor.fm/RackingFocusPodcast, you can actually leave us a message. If you have a question about the movie or you have a question for us in general, you can actually leave a little voice message there, and we'll include that in our next podcast episode, and we'll answer that question for you. That'd be cool to communicate with you guys. So, what else did I miss?
Let's say you didn't miss anything.
That's great.
RackingFocusPodcast.com.
RackingFocusPodcast.com.
That's it. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
And go there and spend your time on that site. Visit us elsewhere, but go there, and we will see you very soon, hopefully in a week.
Yeah.
But there's lots to watch, lots to review, and I feel like we're ready to get back to it. So yep. Thanks for listening.
Yep. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Racking Focus podcast.